Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hello.
How's everyone doing?
Good. Mary Trehune from Boston.
Hey, Mary. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good.
Kathleen from Michigan.
Who from Michigan?
Kathleen.
Oh, hey, Kathleen. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Good.
Hi, Judy from Chicago.
Oh, hey, Judy. How are you?
Good, Kim. How are you?
Are you coming to Arcata?
It's my plan.
Oh, good.
I still haven't booked the ticket, but I'll call you.
Okay, sounds good. Who else is on?
Herb Shock.
Hey, Herb. How are you?
I'm in Phoenix. I'm doing okay.
Okay. Is it warm there?
No, not as warm as you would like it to be, but it's nice.
Good, good. 60. Who else is on this evening?
Hi, everybody. It's Allison.
Hey, Allison. How's it going?
It's great. Hi, Herb.
Hi.
I'm Louise from Edmonton.
Hi, Louise. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello. Fine.
Oh, Louise. Good. How are you doing? I haven't spoken to you in ages.
And who is speaking?
It's Allison, the book lady.
Yes, hello.
How are you doing?
Fine.
You have to take down my toll-free number and call me soon, Louise.
Yeah, where are you? Are you still with the...
No, Whole Health Now has our own book division now, and that's who I'm with.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So, Louise, make a note of this number. Have you got a pen?
Yes, I do have a pen and a paper. Go ahead.
They have good prices, too.
I'm sure. Go ahead, Allison.
866.
866.
599.
599-5950. 5950.
Yeah, and I look forward to hearing from you.
I will call for sure.
Who else is on?
Roy Ozan.
Oh, hey, Roy. How are you?
Good.
Good? You're coming up to Arcata.
Yeah.
Great. I'll look forward to showing you around the area.
Great.
So who else? Anybody else want to say hi? Will, are you on yet? Okay, well, he's not on, so we can continue to talk a little bit amongst ourselves.
Marcia, Vancouver Island.
Hey, Marcia, how's it going?
Good, good.
Good. So you know that Dr. Taylor is going to be coming to Vancouver on May 1st and May 2nd.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, it should be a pretty amazing seminar. If you've never seen him speak, he's pretty dynamic and incredibly knowledgeable.
Yeah.
He's good. Talking about yourself, Kim?
Oh, no.
Yes, he is, actually.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and get started. First of all, I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody out, and I'll do a formal interview for maybe the first 45 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to the general group, and if people have some specific questions they'd like to ask, that would be fine.
Don't need to do anything on our end.
Nobody has to do anything. I'll take care of all of that. Okay, so I'm going to mute everybody out, and then I'll introduce Dr. Taylor, and we'll continue from there. And then I'll unmute us towards the end of the call, and then people can ask their own questions, okay? So
great.
Hold on a second. So, Will, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, first of all, thank you so much for being on the call tonight. Let me just give you a quick introduction. Dr. Taylor he's a genius. He's one of the most brilliant researchers and practitioners that we have in homeopathy. And what's particularly amazing about Will is his ability to integrate the old-time classics of homeopathy, the Organon and the works of Kant and Lippe, with contemporary and newly discovered ideas that are being revealed all the time by current practitioners. And this is an amazing ability, amazing art to be able to really integrate these two things together. So Will is he's one of the most knowledgeable people in homeopathy. He's a scholar of the Organon. He's incredibly eloquent. He can wax poetic about just about any topic you can possibly imagine. And he's an incredibly proficient practitioner as well. So let me just give you a very warm welcome from all of us here on the call. Will, are you still there?
Yeah. Gosh, I hope I can follow up
on that. Okay.
Let me do an experiment for a moment. I want to tell you if my voice is coming over better like this. I've got an earphone on. Or if I unplug a second. And if I talk like
this. Oh, that's quite a bit better, Will.
This is better?
Yes, a lot better.
Okay, well, we'll go with this then.
Okay, all right. So as I was mentioning to people on the call, you are going to be doing a seminar on May 1st and May 2nd on chronic and subacute miasms and contemporary expansions in Vancouver, British Columbia. If people want more information about that, they can either call us at our toll-free number, 888-722-5423, or they can go and visit our website at wholehealthnow.com/Taylor. And we thought that tonight's interview would be focused on miasms, since this is a subject that it creates a lot of confusion in the homeopathic community, and Dr. Taylor has done quite a bit of research on the use of miasms in practice, and I thought it would be something that he could probably enlighten us a little bit about. So, Will, I guess the first question I want to ask you is, it seems that, you know, when people talk about miasms, they oftentimes have different definitions of what a miasm actually is, and I think if we're not using the same terminology, we can oftentimes get into conflicts, and really the source of that conflict is really the fact that we're just not understanding the word in the same way. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what actually is a chronic miasm.
Sure, and you're going to hear a lot of opinions, so I'll tell you the real one, the real answer, and you can, I'm decent. And then, this is strange when people can't laugh back. At
I know, well, I'll laugh
jokes. Okay. but, you know, sometimes the term miasm is merely used as kind of a convenient way to classify remedies into groups or to kind of classify diseases into various realms. And in fact, Hahnemann meant something much more fundamental with his use of chronic miasm. The term miasm actually comes from an old term that really means contagious disease. It was before the germ theory was fully developed, but the notion that this is actually something that you catch and that takes grip of your health and in a particular way. And this is the sense in which I like to really use the term chronic miasms. Hahnemann really posited that the way we fall into chronic derangements of health is by actually catching something, you know, catching SORA or catching psychosis or catching syphilis or catching tuberculosis. And these take, you know, these seem to be diseases which can take grip of our organism and which we are not fully capable of throwing off without some assistance. And they redirect the efforts of the dynamis, of the vital force of the body, so that our health is permanently deranged in a particular direction.
Great. That's a great definition. You know, it seems that there's many opinions about miasms as there are homeopaths, you know, if you look through the literature. And I know it's pretty puzzling for people when they're trying to understand this. And especially when you look at the history of homeopathy, you notice that there's a lot of practitioners who never really even utilized the idea of miasms in their practice. And they seem to have gotten fairly good results. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, you know, it took Hahnemann a long time to come to this. And it took him actually kind of an interesting phase in his career. You know, there came this time when Hahnemann was being persecuted by the apothecaries in Leipzig and was at risk of being arrested and really had to hightail it out of Leipzig and found himself practicing in the little town of Curtin, which was a small town and to a cosmopolitan fellow like Hahnemann, kind of slower paced than what he was used to. And folks were pretty healthy there, and he had a pretty slow practice. He had a lot of time to focus on the people who kept coming back to see him, you know, repeatedly, and a lot of time to reflect on chronic illness. So, you know, I'm sorry, just ran downstairs to grab something. And there was a lot of space in his life and time to really reflect on this. And I think it's not something that a lot of homeopaths have done since, have put the kind of time into. Hahnemann's ideas of about the chronic miasms came relatively late in his career, after a lot of homeopathy had been launched, after people went off in other directions. And, you know, we see a lot of homeopaths in our lineage who just have not really been influenced by the notion, by the concept, and are able to do reasonable work, which doesn't mean they couldn't have done better work with a fuller appreciation of how the chronic, you know, understanding of the chronic miasms can assist us in case analysis and appreciation of disease. So, you know, we find a lot of kind of fragmentary incorporation into our literature. The other point is that the chronic diseases is a bit of a dense book to read. And suffered tremendously from its translation into English, both in readability and in content. And so it really takes being able to sit down with it and digest it and read it slowly and read it again. It's really a treasure trove, but I know very, very few people who've waded through it and appreciated it fully.
When you read it's interesting. Do you think that can you get good results in practice without using the miasmatic theory?
Yeah, I think you can. The bottom line is that we try to match the characterizing symptoms of a remedy with the totality of characterizing symptoms of a case. And if we regard the totality of characterizing symptoms of the case as kind of a laundry list of symptoms, and if we regard the characterizing symptoms of a remedy as kind of a laundry list of symptoms, we're going to often be able to find a match between those. We have our methods, we have our ways, and yet this isn't, we can do better work than this. Stuart Close in The Genius of Homeopathy talks about the totality of symptoms of a case and says, really, this is not just a laundry list of symptoms. It's a list of symptoms that are organized and held together by the thread of an idea. And he likens it to a portrait. And a portrait is not just a pair of eyes and a nose and a mouth, but it's a pair of eyes and nose and a mouth held together in a particular relationship with each other. There's kind of some meta information here that tells us where things are placed and how they relate to each other. And in the same way, a totality of symptoms of a case is when we can best appreciate it, it's a list of symptoms that are held together by threads and themes. And these threads and themes are communicated to us by the miasms. This is the kind of information that understanding the miasms gives us. So when we look at the same case with this added knowledge, this added appreciation of how things are held together, there's just this additional information that can help us focus in and see a better match with remedies, but between our cases and remedies.
Thank you for that answer. Will, one of the other questions I've been dying to ask you is, Hahnemann basically focused on three miasms, psora, psychosis, and syphilis, and some practitioners also pretty much focused on those three. Some added tubercular or pseudosora, and some added cancer. And then even more recently today, there are models where there are even 10 miasms being utilized. And maybe you could comment about that, and maybe even also talk a little bit about the idea of remedies being considered trimiasmatic, relative to one remedy being only associated with one miasm.
Sure, good. Yeah, there's been a lot made of the three miasms versus more than three miasms question. And three is a really nice number. And so when Hahnemann first posited his three miasms, as that notion kind of filtered down in time, there's a lot of trappings that have been placed on that. It's especially tempting because of his initial three chronic miasms, psora and psychosis and syphilis, we can tell some kind of general stories. We can kind of use a key word of difficulties in assimilation with psora. And we can kind of use a key word of proliferation and excess with psychosis, and a key word of destruction with syphilis. And when you create a triad of those, assimilation, excesses, and destruction, there's kind of an old story that falls out, kind of an old story that fits in with many notions of cosmology and the Hindu cycle of creation and destruction and creation and I think James Heller Kent really glommed on with his Swedenborgian philosophy to the Christian notion of the triad of, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost in here. And so three is a tempting number to stay with, but it's really important to reflect that Hahnemann did not freeze us at three. Late in his career, he looked back at his description of psora, and he said, I've included too much in here. and I always like to think of the chronic miasms as whales. It's just an image to keep in my mind. And he said, you know, I've been telling me about one kind of whale, but in fact, I've been seeing humpbacks and blue whales, and I didn't know they were different from each other. I just saw them rising next to each other, and it was easy to pick out the cicada whales, the gray whales. They have warts, you know, barnacles on them, okay? And it was easy to pick out the sperm whales with the harpoon wounds in them. That's syphilis, you know, with the ulcers, okay? But these other two, these blue whales and these humpback whales, this sora and this pseudosora, I confused with each other. And so late in his career, he sorted these out and actually gave us four chronic miasms. And pseudosora we now refer to as tuberculosis, a term that wasn't in widespread use in his day. And he talked about other miasms, too. Of course, he talked about acute miasms, with the acute diseases such as smallpox. And in between these two, he talked about things like that he called subacute miasms. And the one he speaks of mostly is rabies, which is a disease that, unlike sora, you know, sora, the bad news is you're going to live, you know. You're going to live with this and you're going to suffer with this, okay? It doesn't kill you. And that's the definition of the chronic miasms. They create a lot of suffering, a lot of expressions of disease, but they tend not to kill you, at least not very fast. Rabies kills you, but it can hang around a long time in the doing so. And so he called this a subacute miasm. You know, it kind of shares with acute diseases the idea that it either goes away or kills you in the end. But meanwhile, it can last a long, long, long time. So, you know, here are five miasms, you know, four chronic and this additional subacute miasm that Hahnemann talked about in his lifetime. And so, you know, that kind of magic number of three was already broken for us. We don't have to cling to it. And tuberculosis doesn't fit into this easy cosmology of assimilation, excess, and destruction because it has all three within it. The tubercular miasm shares with sores and difficulties with assimilation, shares with psychosis, proliferative changes, and shares with syphilis, some destructive tendencies. So we lose our easy cosmology, and it kind of opens us up to saying, well, what else is out there? The chronic miasms in Hahnemann's view were things that we caught. Sora was a contagious critter that we, you know, a bug that we caught, and lots of ideas about what that may have been. Psychosis was a venereal disease that we caught. Syphilis was a venereal disease that we caught. Later on, the notion, you know, the observation was made that these things could be passed on from generation to generation as well. Tuberculosis, again, there's a bacterium, there's a thing that you can catch. I think we can easily look at things like Lyme disease and ponder whether we should call Lyme a chronic miasm or a subacute miasm, perhaps. We clearly see chronic diseases fall into some groups that don't easily fit into those four major chronic miasms or the rabies subacute miasm of Hahnemann. We see patients who come in with chronic complaints that don't easily fit those patterns, but they cluster together. So there are folks who need remedies like arginine or staphysagria or anacardium or nitric acid. And these diseases seem to form a coherent cluster to us. You know, it seems reasonable to give them a group and to suggest they belong to their own chronic miasms. And so contemporary homeopaths have coined this notion of what they call the cancer miasm to encompass that group. It's a name I don't particularly like, and we might talk about that later. But, you know, and such. And then, of course, Roshan Sankaran has gone on in this way of saying there's some coherency to groups of diseases that we can kind of cluster together and propose things like the malarial miasm, the typhoid miasm. And, you know, these things have real clinical utility. I find a lot of usefulness in them in my practice. What the etiology of these may be is very strange to think about. You know, if chronic miasms are things that are caught, what does one catch that gives one the cancer miasm? Is an interesting question. Certainly not cancer, and the cancer miasm has very little to do with cancer, it appears. What does one catch that puts one into the typhoid miasm? I'm not quite sure what that would be. But there are a lot of questions in the universe.
You know, Will, are you finished? Or can
I'm rattling on here, huh?
No, that was great. That was really very, very good. You know, in my homeopathic studies, I trained with Sheila Creasy, and she always used to say that the tubercular miasm was really psoria syphilis. And
yeah.
I was curious if you had had an experience of that in your own practice or in your studies, if you'd seen that kind of analogy between.
Well, here's the thing. I think there are two ways to look at this, and depending on how we want to use our words. If we want to get really Hahnemannian, we have to say the tubercular miasm is a miasm that stands on its own. And, you know, there's a contagious source of it, the tubercular bacillus. It tends to cluster in families. I've got a Christmas card that I get every year from a patient's family, and it's great. There's this whole lineup. They got a whole bunch of kids. This is a whole lineup of kids with their triangular faces and bright red lips and bushy full eyelashes and, you know, kind of purplish raccoon shadows under their eyes. And, you know, it's kind of the whole family group of the tubercular miasm here. So, you know, it's not like this is really a coming together of three different miasms. Now J.H. Allen, in his book, The Chronic Miasms, proposed this notion that what we call the tubercular miasm is really a combination, a coming together of psora and psychosis. Psora and syphilis. And if we look at the tubercular miasm, we can kind of see where we come up with that idea. There's a lot of things that looked like psora. I mean, Hahnemann confused the tubercular miasm with psora for many, many years of his career, and he was a pretty astute fellow. So we find the sweaty head, we find difficulties assimilating things, we find the large head with delayed closing the fontanelle in both of these chronic miasms, and many other aspects to compare those to. But then we see the destructiveness of tuberculosis with its, you know, its caseous abscesses in the lungs and other tissues and the destruction of joints and so on, and it sounds kind of syphilitic. And then we see, you know, the behavior that can kind of tend toward the destructiveness of syphilis. And so it's tempting to say it's kind of a hybrid. And yet I think what we're really dealing with is something that stands on its own that looks like these. I think if we kind of draw the Venn diagram of the tubercular miasm, it overlaps with the issues of psora and the issues of syphilis and even the issues of psychosis. To some extent, but I don't think it's really from having both of those traits carried on. Am I making sense?
Yeah, that's really very interesting. You know, another question I wanted to, you know, that I know comes up a lot for a lot of homeopaths, and, you know, you see it in the old literature, but you see it among contemporary homeopaths too, is that they say, like, well, Hahnemann was really brilliant in his early years, you know, after the discovery of the law of similars in 1796, or, you know, first writing about it, and then, you know, the whole idea of homeopathy as it developed, and he was really brilliant. But then, you know, when he really fully developed the idea of miasms later in life, he was, at that point, didn't have the same level of mental clarity, and this was really kind of the meanderings of somebody in the late stages of his life when he didn't have the mental acuity that he did earlier on. So I thought maybe you could, because I think I hear this from contemporary homeopaths, and you see it in the old literature, and I thought maybe you could comment on that. And also maybe I thought you could comment as well on Hahnemann's remark that pretty much everybody has psora, except he said he himself didn't have psora.
Sure.
And could you comment on those two items?
Sure. yeah. Well, you know, I think the most succinct thing to come to, you know, Hahnemann's work on the chronic diseases was during his sojourn in Köthen, in a little village near Leipzig in Germany. And I think one of the clearest suggestions that he was nowhere as near senile during that period is that the way he left Köthen was a 30-year-old woman came from France under the guise of having an ovarian cyst, married him within a few days and whisked him off to Paris with her. And I'll tell you, if I'm able to pull that off when I'm senile, I think, anyway, he was a very, very vital character right up to the day he died. Some of Hahnemann's best work, his development of the LM potencies, was done in his Paris years. So, and you know, we have his case studies from the Paris years, which were well after he developed this notion of chronic diseases. So I think I think those who made the suggestion have made it kind of based on notions of his age and the stage in his life, but without reflecting on the historical record. The guy was sharp up until the end. The notion of Hahnemann not having Sora, I think, is at once amusing and interesting to speculate on. You know, the way this comes up, the way he says that, you know, Hahnemann didn't have many nice things to say about a lot of people, and there's a lot of rants in his Organon, and it's entertaining to read. And sometimes we walk away from that feeling that this was an extremely haughty character and such. And I think I used to feel the same way, and I have a different read on him now. When he talked about Sori, he said, this is so contagious that even the hermit on Mount Sorat is affected. And even the prince in his swaddling clothes is infected by the swaddling nurse. And so he said, but I don't have it. Of those that I know, I'm one of the very few that I know who are not affected by Sora. He didn't give us a long list of who else that might include. He knew Goethe. I would suspect he would include Goethe in that list if he'd had written a long list. But the reason he wrote this was to say, this is why I was able to appreciate this. He said, this is why, in looking at all of these patients who've seen me, why I've been able to pick out these symptoms, because I haven't suffered this itching, and I haven't suffered this. And this is a very important point, I think, in the mental-emotional realm, this looking out at the world and seeing the world is very big, and how am I going to cope? And he said, I haven't suffered this. So I look at other people, and it glares at me. I see it very, very clearly. So he wasn't saying this to brag or to gloat. He was saying it to say, this is how I was able to perceive these subtle symptoms that otherwise I might have totally missed. I strongly suspect the guy was without Sora, and I think what we see that sounds like arrogance on his part when he writes and goes into his rants is a combination of the method of writing in his day and a very non-Soric tendency, which is a tendency to see the world very clearly and as it is and accept no bullshit from it. And so when Hahnemann says, these docs in Leipzig are absolutely full of shit, I think he was just being brutally honest and clear and not about to take silliness for an answer from him. I think he just didn't hold back. And when he saw an idiot, he described him as an idiot. And he was usually right.
Well, I like that answer, Will.
Yeah, and I'm glad he's not looking over my shoulder today.
That was great. So since we're talking about Sora, there's common understanding that Sora, common literature says that Sora is derived from scabies mite, and since Sora, as written in the chronic diseases, is the root of all disease, basically so one would assume that the scabies mite somehow is the cause of all human suffering or all chronic disease. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Well, this is a really interesting piece, and this kind of goes in with the senility theory, because where I found this in the literature, these two things are linked, kind of ridiculing Sora as being scabies and then kind of extending from that into saying, oh, he was senile and he's just putting all this stuff together. But here's some interesting things. Prior to his excursion into homeopathy, prior to 1780, Hahnemann had written a monograph on scabies. He was, he had a microscope. Van Leeuwenhoek had developed that, some 150 years earlier or something. He described the mite and its anatomy. He described the appearance of the mite in detail. He described the course of infection with scabies and the progression of symptoms in really quite a bit of detail. So we have that in the literature. And then we come into Hahnemann's chronic diseases, and we read about this if you search for the word scabies in the chronic diseases, you don't find it once. It's not there. You find it in a couple of articles that he references where he talks about things, but not centrally. And he doesn't use the word himself, so he was well aware of the scabies mite and the course of its infection. And yet, in the whole chronic diseases, he does not mention the word scabies once. And then if you read his description, I don't think many people wade through this. It took me, my sixth or seventh reading of the chronic diseases to say, I'm finally going to read this whole section. I think I was constipated and had a lot of time on the toilet that week. And I dug in and read his description of the primary infection with psoriasis. And it is very, very different from the description of an infection with scabies. It's a whole different phenomenon. So I think that there's a translation problem that's part of this. I think so much of the German our literature, of course, Hahnemann's writings were in German. The early homeopaths of this country operated in German, worked in German. When they started translating into English, often some of those translations were a little awkward. And I think the word itch got translated as scabies many times in some pieces of peripheral literature. And so we walk away with this notion, but it's very, very clear that in describing Sora, Hahnemann was describing some sort of itching eruption, in which the itching is profound and the eruption is really pretty nondescript itself. Little tiny water-filled vesicles that are minuscule, very different than scabies. So I have my theories of what SORA is, and I share them in private sometimes. But if you wander me into that direction, I want you to know that.
Well, I was curious if you thought there was a relationship between Candida diatasis and.
That's exactly what I think SORA is. Mm-hmm. You read the description of the primary infection with SORA. And it sounds exactly like candidiasis, Manilia, albicans, and, common yeast, which is ubiquitous. It's almost impossible to be without it in your system. And most of us live with it pretty latently. It can cause problems for some. So I think that, William Crookes' yeast connection book is in the right direction, but kind of off on a far limb. As well, okay. But I wouldn't want anyone to walk away from this conversation saying, oh, that's what this is. Understand this may be the meanderings of a semi-senile fellow from Maine recently moved to Oregon.
Okay, thanks. So, in Hahnemann's writings, he basically attributes pretty much all chronic disease, except for the venereal diseases, which is a much smaller portion, to SORA.
Mm-hmm.
And, in my own practice, and, I think other people who are practicing, they don't kind of see that connection between SORA and most of their diseases. So maybe you could comment on that. Is there a change in the chronic miasm since Hahnemann's day, or what's going on with all that?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a very huge change. And one of the things that I notice, let me put that piece off for a second. Hahnemann's first model of a chronic disease was psychosis. And he just noticed that a lot of people who had chronic problems could date their history back to when they were infected with figwarts and coxcomb lesions, okay? The venereal warts. And we'll talk about what psychosis is in a moment. There's another tremendous misconception about this in the homeopathic world, too. Of what psychosis is. Psychosis came into Western Europe during Hahnemann's lifetime. He recalls, and he relates in the chronic diseases, the particular military campaigns following which psychosis started appearing in the Western European population. So this was a relatively new disease for him to work with. Syphilis had only predated Hahnemann by, in any sort of large scale, probably about 200 years or so. So again, it was relatively recent in Western Europe. We know that syphilis entered Western Europe, 1490s, and you know, came back as a part of the colonial expansion of Europe, coming home, probably introduced from Northern Africa, both to Europe and to North America about that time. So these were relatively new for him, and they're not so new to us now. They've had a lot of time to spread. They've had a lot of time to be suppressed, and become more prevalent in their latent and secondary forms, as well as to be passed along genetically, but hereditarily. Tuberculosis in Hahnemann's day, you know, we read about all these manifestations of tuberculosis we don't see today in Western society because, you know, they saw a lot of primary tuberculosis. So we see a lot of these strange terms in our literature from them. We don't see this much anymore, but we have the sequelae of suppressed and secondary tuberculosis rampant from the mammoth efforts to suppress the primary disease through the early 1900s, 1920s, and in 1930s in North America and Europe. So tubercular miasmatic disease, secondary tuberculosis, has become much, much more common. I also have a theory, and humor me with this because maybe it's just totally silly, but we know that two of the expressions of the tubercular miasm are these. One is a feeling that one is being persecuted for their inner weaknesses, and someone's taking advantage of them and persecuting them. And another is a desire to travel and the notion that geographic solutions like buying a new car or having a new girlfriend or moving to another state are going to solve your problems. So where did people like that in Europe between 1492 and 2004 go, you know? They were persecuted for their religion, and they came to North America and Australia. And so I have a theory that we've loaded up North America with a lot of tubercular folks. And it's one of the reasons I've contemplated on this. You know, when I step off the plane in Germany or in France or in the Czech Republic or in Bulgaria, it's a whole different feel. It's a whole different feel to the culture and the ways people relate to one another. And I think that we don't see a lot of tubercular disease there, a lot of suppressed secondary tubercular disease. I think we got a lot in North America. I think we see a lot of sore, a lot of psychosis, a lot of syphilis in Europe. We got that here too, but we see tons and tons of tubercular disease. And we see some common disease expressions of the tubercular miasm, such as chronic recurrent ear infection and attention deficit disorder and obstinate defiant disorder, you know, that are so prevalent in this country. So, I think there's been a big change in the distribution of these.
Yeah, I think it would be very interesting to do some type of research in different parts of the world and see the miasmatic predispositions, you know, like in Africa or Asia.
This is actually an interesting thing. Our source of sorinum, you know, we needed someone recently infected with sora so that we got the fresh little vesicles, which weren't very seen very often, because as Hahnemann said, most of us are born with it in Europe in his day. So where did we get sorinum from? A primary infection? Herring. Was in Suriname, and Suriname was being used. Paramaribo was a slave port. Africans brought in the slave trade for North America were held there, fed after the transatlantic voyage, and strengthened before they were brought north to be sold. He had people who had never been exposed to sora, and were having primary soric infections, and that's where our sorinum comes from. He harvested the fluid contents of the blisters of a slave with primary sora. So here again, you know, we look at this distribution of the chronic miasms worldwide, you know, before we started globally mixing things up so much.
That's a great answer, Will. I really appreciate that.
Thanks.
Yeah. You know, Will, one of the things that, you know, if you read the remedy Metarhinum,
mm-hmm.
it looks a lot like, it has a lot of the symptoms of the tubercular miasm,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, but of course Metarhinum is supposed to be for the psychotic miasm. There seems to be this confusion between tuberculinum and Metarhinum and the miasms they're associated with. Do you have any comments on that? Or?
Yeah. This was something that always drove me nuts. You know, I, the more I learned about Metarhinum and trying to fit it into the psychotic miasm, it felt like trying to force a square peg into a round hole. And people do this, and you'll see this happen, and you'll say, well, wait a minute, you know, all this stuff about excesses and you know the kinds of excesses in Metaranum and so on, they don't sound like those that I see in Thuya, which is supposed to be such a central psychotic biasm remedy. And Metaranum just sounds a lot like Tuberculinum. You know, there's this polar, very, you know, sweetness and affectionate nature that alternates or polarizes against a totally, you know, outrageous and extravagantly aggressive nature and so on. And, you know, this doesn't seem to fit and work. And reflecting on this one day, you know, I got to thinking, and I was reading about psychosis and the coxcomb lesions and the fig warts for which it's named. And psychosis comes from the Greek word for fig, describing these fig wart, the genital warts that characterize it. I thought, well, wait a minute, this isn't gonorrhea. Psychosis is not gonorrhea at all. And you dig back into the literature and you read Hahnemann and you read his descriptions of psychosis, and he talks about how central these figwort and coxcomb lesions are, these wart lesions, are to this disease. And he mentions urethral discharges often accompanying them, which you see with these conditions. But then you see in Hempel's translation into the English, he takes the German word for urethral discharge and translates it as gonorrhea. And I'm wondering if in that day gonorrhea meant capital G, Neisseria gonorrhea, bacterial gonorrhea, as we use it today. I suspect it likely didn't. So here we've got this tremendous confusion by perhaps a mistranslation, perhaps a difference in the historical meaning of words. And psychosis has nothing to do with gonorrhea. Psychosis is about genital warts, human papillomavirus, totally different disease. And now it all falls in and makes sense. And Metaranum, you know, what does Metaranum do? Metaranum is all about these mucopurulent discharges, right? You know, gonorrhea is this mucopurulent discharge from the urethra. What's the tubercular miasm about? You know, you read about in Chowdhury, Indications of Miasm, and he talks at length about how the abscess and the mucopurulent discharge of an abscess or discharging mucopurulent discharges are the primary lesion of the tubercular miasm. Sora, it's the itch with a barely visible eruption. Syphilis, it's that ulcer. You know, psychosis, it's the figwort. Tubercular miasm, it's the mucopurulent discharge. And that's what gonorrhea is about. It's a tubercular disease, and Metaranum is really a tubercular remedy and not psychotic at all. We don't have a nosode of the psychotic miasm. I know that I've, you know, seen, you know, and you can find human papillomavirus potentized, you know, but no one's done a proving on it that I'm aware of, and this would be a very, very valuable thing to do. We really use Thuya as the kind of central undifferentiated remedy of the kind of generic psychotic miasm.
Wow, that was great, Will.
Thanks.
Maybe you could speak a little bit about how the chronic miasms impinge on acute diseases, because I know that that's an area that people have a little bit of unclarity about.
Sure, sure. You know, when Hahnemann talks about the nature of disease in the Organon, he gets around to talking about acute disease and saying basically he identifies five kinds of acute disease. There's acute disease which is individual, and that's purely the response of something that person was exposed to, like falling off your bicycle and bumping your knee, and now you've got an individual acute disease that really has nothing to do with what's going on with other people. It's purely from what happened to you. And your susceptibility has a role in how you manifest that, of course, but the important thing here is what happened to you. The second category are sporadic diseases, and these are diseases that in any population may be affecting a few people at any one time, because of a common cause, but they tend not to affect most of folks, and our individual susceptibility is likely a very important aspect of whether we get sick or not from this. Okay, and then the third kind of acute disease are epidemic diseases, and these are diseases where when they come through a population, many people are affected the same way. And the influence of the offending organism, you know, the virus or whatever, is strong enough that it overrides a great deal of our individual susceptibility, so that although we don't always get all sick in the same way, we mostly do. And the fourth are the acute miasms. These are things, these are epidemic diseases that are so consistent from occurrence to occurrence that we give them a name, like chickenpox. Because, again, not every case looks the same, but they look close enough to the same that we can recognize them and name it each time. And then the fifth category is a very fascinating one. And he says, you know, mostly individual acute diseases, those things that seem to affect just individuals, like that first category, he said mostly these are acute expressions of chronic disease. And I think one of the best examples we have among us is pediatric ear infections. So, you know, kid has an ear infection, you don't yank him out of school and have his classmates stay home and quarantine because it's not the issue that it's contagious. They get sick because of something going on with them. And the thing going on with them is they have a chronic miasmatic disease. And when they're stressed in a particular way, whether it's physically, mental, emotionally, for any variety of stresses that can do this, they express this acute expression. I like to think of it, again, if we think of a chronic miasm like a whale kind of gliding under the water most of the time, not doing very much of interest to us, every now and then it sticks a fluke up above the water. And that's our ear infection. And, you know, we could say, oh, the kid's got an ear infection. That's like saying, oh, there's a whale fin we have to take care of. The truth is, there's a whale we need to take care of. And so in these ear infections, we have to not lose sight that there's a chronic miasmatic disease which is expressing itself momentarily here. Now, that doesn't mean we can't treat the acute disease. I mean, this kid's not sleeping. He's got a fever. Nasty things can happen. Mom's not sleeping. Nobody's sleeping. You know, no problem finding a remedy on an acute basis and treating that ear infection. The problem is if we don't remember that this is a chronic miasmatic disease we're dealing with. So after that ear infection's cleared off, everybody's sleeping at home, you get that kid back and take his case. And so maybe you gave a dose of belladonna and ear infection cleared right up. So I think it's important to say that kids who get ear infections are affected by the tubercular miasm. This is a chronic tubercular disease. And so we have them back. We take their case and find a remedy that addresses the totality of chronic symptoms of the case. And, you know, maybe it's going to be belladonna, which has a tubercular component to it. Or maybe it's going to be CARB or another remedy that has a known relationship to belladonna in this acute to chronic sense. But we got to take care of that whole whale. Or we keep seeing these things that look like acute disease. This is really how Hahnemann came up with the notion of chronic diseases. He was scratching his head and saying, why do they keep coming back? They give them a remedy. They get better. Now they come back either with the same thing or with something that hauntingly reminds me of the thing they came to first. I mean, maybe they first came with a sinusitis, you know? And now they come in with wrist pain. But then they come back with a headache. And but you know, the thing is that all of these are worse with cold, damp weather. And why would that be? Why would a headache and the old sinusitis share this property in common with each other? And he said, that's where he started to realize that one is the left fluke of the whale, one is the nose of the whale, one is the blowhole of the whale, one is the belly of the whale. And he put it all together and said, wait a minute, there's a whale here. And each time I'm just taking care of a part, I need to take care of the whole whale.
You know, I have literally hundreds of more questions to ask you, but I'd like to give people an opportunity to ask questions as well. So I'm just going to ask you one more question, then I'm going to switch it over to the group. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how we know which remedies belong to which chronic miasms.
Sure. I think that this is a pregnant question. You know, I know very often I'm working with a group of students, and we're working on a case together, And we're rolling that case around. I always tell them a case is like a coconut. You got to roll it around and see where it's going to crack. And sometimes the crack is the miasm. But the first thing that's interesting is that this is a tubercular case. So we do that, and we do that, and they say, okay, now which remedies should it be? And I say, oh, well, let's just put that on the side of the table and carry on with our analysis and see how that's going to come in a little bit later. One of the you can go through the whole list of remedies and do some quick sorting and say, for example, thuya is so psychotic, okay, and kelk phos is so tubercular, and tuberculinum is very centrally tubercular. And people have done this historically, and we find, for example, in the family's repertory in RADAR, lists of remedies by miasm, and these come from a variety of sources. And I have to suggest that some of these sources are more reliable than others. And there's some classifications in there that we just have to understand are historically interesting, but may not be as useful as they could be. Chowdhury, in his book Indications of Miasm, has some nice short lists, and I like to use those. And actually, when I worked on the revision of the family's repertory, I made two sections for miasms. One was what had already been in there, and there's a second section, which is Chowdhury's miasm assortments. And these aren't very comprehensive. There are many remedies that aren't listed anywhere that need to be, and there's a lot of work for somebody to do here, to do a really good job of sorting these. Are there people working on this now? I kind of question the notion that there is any sort of one-to-one correlation, okay? For example, thuya is intensely and very centrally psychotic, and yet there are some soric aspects to thuya as well, okay? Mercurius is often described as the central and most descriptive remedy of the syphilitic miasm, and I have no question that that's reasonable to say. And yet, there are some really interesting psychotic and tubercular aspects of Mercurius, and I've used Mercurius in tubercular cases, and even in a case that I would have to say was really psychotic by nature quite deeply, and it served quite well, even though it typically serves that syphilitic realm. So I don't think we really can draw these rigid lines and throw remedies into just one group or another. I know that Rajan Sankaran is playing with this now with his grid of plant families and chronic miasms. And I think it's some very interesting work. I think it deserves tracking. I think that when Rajan presents this, he always prefaces it with saying this is a work in progress. We know Sankaran's history of throwing things out and that are fascinating and wonderful and interesting and seeing them morph and change over the years into new understandings and interpretations. And I fully expect, and I think he fully expects that this will too. But I think that his descriptions, which kind of pigeonhole one remedy into one miasm, are not fully substantiable. I think that most remedies cover more territory than just a single miasm. Belladonna is a great case in point. You know, it's a very central remedy in the rabies miasm, okay, which Sankaran includes in his more inclusive acute miasm. And yet belladonna has some tremendously tubercular characteristics and serves in tubercular cases. I've had belladonna be a curative remedy in children with asthma and in children with chronic recurrent ear infections. Not only is there acute, but is there chronic. You know, it's got the big head with the late-closing fontanelle and the sweaty head and so on that many of the tubercular remedies have as well. So I like to start with the lists in Chowdhury and sometimes expand with the broader lists in the family's database in RADAR. The other thing we can do is kind of appreciate the once we get a good working understanding of the miasms, we don't need so much of these lists anymore. We can look at a remedy and read it and understand it and start to understand, for example, the syphilitic aspects of the remedy guaiacum and understand why. And then when we find it in one of these lists, we're not surprised. We say, oh, yeah, well, that's why it's up there.
Thank you, Will. That was just really fantastic. So let me just reiterate for the people who got on a little bit later that Will will be doing a
two-day seminar on May 1st and 2nd in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia, titled The Chronic and Subacute Miasms and Contemporary Expansions. And it'll be a very practical seminar in terms of actually going through cases and really seeing how to use the miasmatic approach to solve these cases. And I think if you've never seen Will teach live using cases, you're in for a real treat if you can make it up to Vancouver for those dates. Also wanted to mention that Dr. Taylor is available now on www.homeopathicsymposium.com. It's a new website where you can actually see cured video cases, and you will actually see commentary by Dr. Taylor describing the intake, commentary through the intake, differential diagnosis of different remedies, and even a whole theory about the follow-up and so on and so forth. So, again, that's homeopathicsymposium.com. If you haven't had a chance to go and check that out, please do. It's quite an amazing website. I'm going to switch you back so that people can have their questions answered. Again, Will, thank you so much. And
thanks, Kim.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, does anybody have any questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
This is Sherry Nacken.
Uh-huh.
And
hi,
Will.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
And I'm wondering what the situation, where you would place what we're doing with vaccinations these days. You know my interest in that. And autism, and if that would, if you're seeing that in kind of maybe a cancer syphilitic area, or what are your opinions on that?
Sure.
What are we doing here with all of this massive vaccination?
First, Sherry, it's so nice to hear that you have a voice. So I just have seen you typing over the years so much in the mailing lists and discussions, so it's lovely to chat with you. let me go backwards in that question a little bit. Autism, obviously, and I think you would be one of the first to concur with this, when we use the word autism, we're talking about a wide range of disorders, many of which are perhaps unrelated to each other in any sort of a real sense, except how they appear at the surface. And so it's interesting that conventional medicine is now using the term autistic spectrum disorder, which at least has the idea of a spectrum of continuity, but I think it's almost a discontinuous thing. So I think I have seen autism cases that I felt were very psychotic. I've seen autistic cases that I thought were very syphilitic. And I'm very impressed with tubercular pathology in the syphilitic miasm. Tubercular miasm in autism cases. And I know that, for example, there's been a focus on thimerosal and a focus on the measles vaccination, and I don't think either of those are misled. But I think that there may be many other aspects of vaccinosis that are involved in these. I have a child who's currently I'm treating who's responding pretty nicely with Halabarus that I'm very, very, very convinced was related to the pertussis immunization. The timing of it was right. The pathology of the case kind of lines up with that being very tubercular. Pertussis being a very centrally tubercular disease. We reflect on it for a moment, kind of the central generic remedy of whooping cough is Drosera, rotundifolia. And Drosera is one of our most centrally, strikingly tubercular remedies in Armatura medica. We can go on and talk about why that is. But I think suppression of whooping cough and the strange invitation we make to the body with the distorted substance we give as a vaccine. We don't give the whole, vaccination would be quite different if we were really presenting the body with a small dose of the real disease and letting it make a rounded response to the whole experience of the disease. But of course we don't do that. We give the body a very strange substance that really isn't known in nature. We kind of create this. And I'm very impressed, for example, with the tubercular pathologies that ensue following pertussis immunization. I can't tell you it's just very routine for children to get their first ear infection at 4 to 4.5 months of age. which is a week or two after the first pertussis immunization. We see this a lot. I cannot tell you how many parents tell me, I had a really sweet, lovely little infant child developing perfectly normally who became outrageous with tantrums and aggression and what's now being labeled as ADHD or obstinate defiant disorder. And all of this started when they were 4.5 months old, you know, 2 weeks after the pertussis immunization. So I'm quite convinced that we're contributing to tubercular pathology and maybe muddling existing tubercular pathology and really inciting it with the pertussis immunization. You know, obviously with thimerosal, we're playing around with a substance that's very centrally syphilitic. We're also putting, you know, mixing that in with an abnormal disease stimulus, with a measles immunization, for example, and such. So, you know, I'm sure that there are relationships here that are very important.
Thanks, Will. Okay, so we're pretty much running out of time. I'm going to allow one more question. Just again, I want to remind everybody that Dr. Taylor will be teaching in Vancouver, British Columbia on May 1st and 2nd. And if you need more information about that, you can go to wholehealthnow.com/Taylor. So we'll ask one more question, and I think we're going to have Dr. Taylor on for another one of these calls in the very near future. So if you didn't get a chance to have your question answered tonight, please join us for another call. It'll be on a different set of questions and different answers, so we'll be all kinds of new information to learn. Hold on 1 second. Okay, anybody else would like to ask another question? I'm sorry, can't hear you. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, would you like to ask a question?
Yes. Do you see any of the resurgence in tuberculosis coming from the suppression that's going on currently? And also related to that, how about people who are not suppressing by not giving the vaccinations? What sort of sequelae are you seeing in your office if you're treating any of those children? Any tuberculosis sequelae?
Yeah. Well, I think the resurgence of tuberculosis is, you know, our bodies try to, you know, address this disease and express it in a primary form. So as much as it's a nasty disease, when the body is able to express it in a primary form, that's probably preferable to suppressing it in its secondary and more insidious and chronic form. So I don't think that these resurgences we're seeing have so much to do with suppression as they are with kind of the natural course of the disease. Obviously, dealing with tuberculosis is a very serious thing, and we need to have a concerted effort to do it. And I think Western medicine is struggling with what they know best to do, but I don't think ultimately the best solutions are going to come from that quarter. As far as and the other part of the question was about kids who aren't vaccinated, I have kids in the practice, and of course they can get sick too. You know, we have many influences on the illness, but I'm impressed with how, for example, recurrent ear infection seems to be much, much more prevalent among my vaccinated population. Even among those kids in which you can identify tubercular traits, we find, you know, I see more concentration of things like recurrent ear infection in the vaccinated group. You know, there aren't too many issues with health problems from, you know, pertussis the pertussis immunization isn't that good anyway. You know, whenever I see an outbreak of pertussis in Maine, I'm used to seeing 15, 20 cases every fall and midwinter, and usually most of those kids were vaccinated, okay? So, you know, pertussis in children isn't a non-vaccinated population problem. It's a whole population problem. You know, we're starting to see pertussis now in the adult population and the school-aged child population, which is pretty problematic. And conventional medicine's approaches to working with it don't apply. They can't give the vaccination to people of those ages. It's dangerous. It's dangerous anyway, but very dangerous for those populations. you know, we're seeing the results of a social experiment with vaccination with measles, you know, where the measles immunization, measles give the disease gives lasting immunity for lifetime, and it's passed transplacentally to babies, and they carry that immunity into about 2 years of age when they can catch measles. And it used to be that we'd all get it by the age of 10, and moms would pass it on to their infants. And now we're finding after this social experiment with measles that not only are the 15-year-olds getting it and the college kids getting it, but moms only have the transient immunity of the vaccine wears off. They don't pass it transplacentally to their infants, and we're seeing measles epidemics in intensive, you know, in nurseries, in hospital nurseries. It's a nasty disease for those kids. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of experiments, you know, the results of this social experiment of vaccination being played out now. It takes its time. I think the veterinarians are way ahead of us. You know, a generation of dogs is a lot faster than a generation of people, and they're seeing these results of you know, both acute and chronic effects of vaccinosis a lot more acutely than we are, and they're kind of they're in a good position to tell us what to expect.
Well, thank you, Will, very much for the call, and I'll bring everybody back in so they can say thank you as well. Hold on a second. So I'd like to thank everybody who was on the call tonight. And,
thank you, Kim.
Yeah.
Help.
And again, we'll have another one of these calls in the very near future. And wish everybody a very good evening. Thank you again, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Will.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.
Thanks,
you.
Thanks to all
of you. Will.
Bye-bye. Bless everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You still there, Kim?
Hello?
Who's there still?
I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, who's this?
Oh. I didn't think
hello?
I could be heard.
Okay.
Hello? I'm Claudia.
Oh, hi. Okay.
Hello?
Hey, Kim.
Should I hang up?
Come on up.
Should
okay.
I, should
well,
I
take
hang?
Care, everybody. I'm going to hang up now.
Okay, bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.